The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is sponsored in part by DDP Yoga. Working hundreds of matches over the years, that ain't no surprise that my body's taking its share of bumps and bruises. Well, my buddy Diamond Dallas Page knows all about the wear and tear the ring takes on your body because he's been there and done that himself. And his DDP Yoga fitness system was specifically designed to burn fat, reduce pain, and heal from injuries. Dallas is so positive that you'll absolutely love the DDPY program and using the DDPY app that he's going to do something he ain't ever done before. He's going to give you 7 days free to try it out. That's a week to try out the program. Explore the app. Own your life, and it's completely free. DDP Yoga can work for all ages, weights, and fitness levels. It's a kick-ass cardio workout that will dramatically increase your flexibility and strengthen your core like never before. And this is all with minimal joint impact. Just for listeners of the Steve Austin Show, you can save 20% off an annual membership for the DDP Yoga Now app off any DVD pack. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin to get started. And check this out. DDP is headed back to the UK, is putting on another DDPY Inspiration Meets Perspiration workshop for one night only, Thursday, April 19th at Frome Sport and Fitness in Somerset, England. Come on over to this incredible three-hour workshop where you'll get to meet DDP, get a kick-ass workout, and hear DDP's secrets to staying motivated. Get your workshop tickets at ddpyogaworkshops.com. You can't make the workshop? Don't worry. You can still catch DDP in person at the Wales Comic-Con April 21st and April 22nd. Details and tickets are at WalesComicCon.com.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm sitting over at my podcast table at 317 Gimmick Street. Old Cali, my black lab, 1 year and 1 month old, is sleeping on her side beside me, watching my back. We have a black cat. I believe I've told you guys about him on a podcast. He's over there in the front yard. My wife and I have been feeding this cat for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. Cat's got a collar on it, got a tag on it. Nobody answered the ad my wife placed in a local newspaper. We just got to have a heart trap. My mission now is to try to set the have-a-heart trap, catch the cat, make sure we do it and we do not harm him. That's why it's called a have-a-heart trap. Take the collar off his neck because it's too damn tight, and then take him down to our vet so he can get his shots, or she can get his shots and any other kind of medical care we can get for it. So anyway, we got this have-a-heart trap. I'm going to place it outside. We'll leave it there for a couple of days for the cat to get used to seeing it. And then we'll put a can of cat food in there and catch the cat and do all this process to him. Now, the cat, I'm guessing the cat's 4, 5, 6 years old. I don't know. I'm just looking at the damn thing, but his collar's too tight. So he's been taking care of himself for a pretty good while. But with that collar on his neck, God dang, I think it's getting a little bit tight. So we've got to catch his ass, take him down there, and get him fixed up. Now, I can cut that collar off of him once I get that, get him in that trap. But I ain't going to get scratched like a sumbitch trying to help that little rascal out. So anyway, that's my little project I'm working on right now. Over there in Nevada at the Broken Skull Ranch 2.0, I got a skunk and a muskrat that I got to have a heart trap over there for. And I tell you what, I think I told you guys last time, a couple of podcasts ago, I seen that skunk out there and I grabbed my .22. This is before I got the have a heart trap from Tractor Supply. Ran out there and I couldn't get the clip in the gun. And had I popped a cap in that skunk, he's probably going to spray stuff everywhere. So luckily I didn't get the clip in the gun. I didn't get a chance to shoot the damn thing. But biggest thing is, I don't want that damn skunk to spray one of my dogs. Way back in the day when we was in South Texas, Hershey the Wonder Dog, when she was still alive, got squirted by a skunk at close range. Man, you talk about a mess. We were out there pouring ketchup on her, mustard, Bloody Mary mix, all kinds of stuff. Man, we was 50 miles out in the middle of nowhere at the Broken Skull Ranch, and it was late at night. Vets weren't open. Anyway, we got, you know, The smell stayed on her for probably about 4, 5, 6 weeks. I mean, it started dissipating and getting less, but you could still smell that skunk on her. And the bad thing was that damn spray that they come out with is so damn powerful that it singed and burned her eyes. And boy, that pissed me off. When you mess with my damn dog, you're pissing me off. So I'm over here. I'm getting into trapping business. That time when I talked with Mitch Bailey, my brother-in-law, about trapping over in Nevada, he's running his trap lines, catching all kinds of stuff. I'm trying to catch a cat over here in Marina Del Rey. Then in Nevada, I'm trying to catch a muskrat and a skunk. Well, you think about a muskrat. A lot of people don't know what a muskrat is. Kind of like a beaver in a way. But we get a pond there in the backyard, and them damn muskrats get in there and dig holes and mess up your pond. So that's why you want to eliminate those guys. Now, I will catch the muskrat in the Have a Heart trap and relocate him. I'll let him go. Now, if I can do the same thing with the skunk, that's my goal as well. Well, Steve, you old trapping son of a gun, you, how do you plan on doing that? Well, what I figure on, if I catch that skunk and he's settled down, if I sneak up behind him, drop a blanket over that trap, put him in the back of my Kawasaki Mule Pro FXT, haul his ass a couple miles down the road, well, then's the tricky part. I got to release him. I'll find a way to get that door up and let the skunk go free. Maybe I'll take him up that trailhead that we've been walking at when I brought my nephew and my nieces out there. I don't know. But it seems like right now, the sense of urgency I got going on over here is catching a black cat, taking him to the vet, cutting that collar off his neck, catching a skunk and a muskrat. I'm going into the trapping business. Ain't selling no hides. Everything is on a catch and release program. That's how we roll. Anyway, over here messing around 317 Gimmick Street. I'm glad Callie came over here. That little dog next door. I ought to set a Have a Heart trap for that son of a bitch. Get him some toys to play with because his owner ain't giving enough attention. That damn thing is driving me crazy. I think I'm going to call up my doctor down there in San Antonio and say, hey, Jimmy, I need some Xanax. I got a dog next door just irritating the living hell out of me. I can't sleep. I can't work. I can't do nothing without that damn dog yapping and barking in my damn ear. Hell, I was thinking about actually getting some hearing aids a while back because my older brother Scott is 2 years older than me. He wears hearing aids. I thought I had bad hearing until he got a set of hearing aids, and I said, hey, man, how are those things? He said, Steve, they'll change your life. And I said, well, maybe I'll seriously consider giving those things, you know, a try. Well, I ain't going to give them a try now because if I could hear better, I know I can hear my illustrious wife, Kristen, barking out more orders for me to do. And that would mean I would be able to hear that dog bark louder than he's already barking right now. And as deaf as a doornail as I am, I can hear that little bastard loud and clear, even when I'm across the way over at 316 Gimmick Street. Got all the windows closed, trying to go to sleep. I hear that little bastard over there, yap, 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 driving me crazy. So, scratch your hearing aids. I ain't getting none now. The little bastard dog is terrorizing me over here. I tell you what, I got James Ellsworth joining me on the podcast today. James reached out a couple weeks ago on direct message. And he says, hey, Steve, if you ever want to, I'd be glad to be on your podcast and I enjoy talking to you. Hell, man, I shot him a damn direct message back. That's what I love about Twitter. And got his phone number and we set up a conversation. And I always enjoyed watching James' career when he got into WWE. I never heard of him up until then. Didn't know he'd been in the business since 2002. Didn't know that Axel Rotten had trained him. We're talking about all that. I know he's been on a couple of other podcasts before. We're just going to shoot the breeze, get into his career with WWE. We're going to cover some other ground and territory that maybe wasn't covered before. But I enjoyed my conversation with James. He's a testament to a guy who, you know, like he says, before that match with Braun Strowman, when he cut that promo, you know, he got that character over. He's not the biggest guy in the world. He's not the guy that when you're looking in that locker room, he's just going to jump off the screen at you and say, holy smokes, superstar alert, superstar alert. But the dude got over with some good storyline and with his ability. So I give him a lot of credit for that. WWE gave him his notice a while back. He's been gone. The door is open for him to return maybe down the road if they come up with something for him. But you're about to hear me and James Ellsworth open up a can of audio whoop-ass. But before we get to my interview with James Ellsworth, let me ask you guys, have you ever felt uncomfortable on a job site? Like if you're a pro wrestler and you're headed down to the ring to open up a can of whoop-ass, but you put your vest on inside out. Or what if you're down on the mat looking up at the lights and the referee says 1, 2, 3, and you wasn't supposed to do the favors? That's awkward, right? If this kind of stuff happens on a job site, work can be uncomfortable. So at least get work gear that is comfortable. Timberland Pro makes shirts, pants, and boots for all kinds of jobs and all kinds of weather, so you can do your best work day in and day out. Head to toe, Timberland Pro. Not uncomfortable.
Hi, I'm Spencer Raskoff, the CEO of Zillow Group, and I have a new podcast here on Podcast One called Office Hours. Listen as I have one-on-one conversations with other CEOs. We have the kind of conversations that can only happen between peers, tackling tough questions, sharing hard-won insights, and helping to define what leadership means today. Join me twice a month on Office Hours, exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the new Podcast One app.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
All right, man, I'm sitting here at 317 Gimmick Street. I'm rolling sound. I got James Ellsworth on the end of the phone on Skype. James, how are you today?
I'm cool, man. The 317 Gimmick Street reminds me of a shirt I just bought at Hot Topic. It was the Austin 317 for St. Patrick's Day.
Dude, tell me about that shirt, because I've been seeing those things everywhere, and I don't even know the gist behind it. What is the story with those things? It is a St. Patrick's Day gimmick or what?
Yeah, and Hot Topic, I was in there and I saw, you know, the old school Austin 316 shirt, and then right under it was Austin 317 for St. Patrick's Day, the date for St. Patrick's Day is 317, so I went ahead and bought it, and I think I tweeted you the picture.
God dang, I saw that picture, and I saw Noel Foley had a picture of a 317 shirt. You know, I don't know if you knew this or not, but WWE trademarked 316, so nobody else can use 316 on a t-shirt, including yours truly. Anytime they go somewhere, whether it's Dallas, Houston, Chicago, they got the 316 shirts. Pretty damn smart. But I guess they didn't trademark the 317 shirts because they're at Hot Topics.
Yeah, I think the 316 one is a WWE shirt there at Hot Topic. I'm not sure if the 317 one is or not, but I purchased one and wore it on St. Patrick's Day. And I'm sure Noel Foley looked a lot cooler in it than I did.
I don't know about cooler, but she did a good job of repping the 317. How's that?
We'll just leave it at that, I guess.
Hey, dude, when I called you the other day, we were talking on the phone, and it's the first time we've ever really got a chance to talk about a whole lot of stuff. But you were down there. I know you live in Baltimore, Maryland, but you were doing an appearance somewhere. What are you doing these days now that you're post-WWE?
Man, I'm doing a little bit of everything. Like, I'm just trying to, you know, give back to the wrestling fans. Like, I believe that they're the reason, you know, I got to sign with WWE and live my dream. So I do anything, like, you know, whether it's a signing or an independent show or, like, just stuff that they enjoy on YouTube. I do anything that they enjoy the James Ellsworth character to do to, you know, try to reach out and meet them and just have fun with the character still.
Man, when did you start training to get into business? Because I read that you were trained by Axel Rotten.
Yes, 2002, fresh out of high school. I graduated like June the 1st, 2002, when I started wrestling at 17 years old, June the 5th of 2002.
What were you doing on the side? Were you wrestling and that was it? Or did you have a job on the side as well?
Oh, yeah. When I started when I was 17, like, I worked at Burlington Coat Factory for a couple of years. Then, I would wrestle 2-3 times a week. And I'd also, after Burlington Coat Factory, I worked with people with special needs, helping them to find jobs and things of that nature. But, yeah, I was on the independents for 14 years before signing with WWE.
Jesus Christ, dude, that's a long time to be on the indie scene.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't easy for a guy like me, $170 soaking wet, brick in my pocket, you know, not really cosmetically cleansing enough for WWE, as they would say. But I just kept going, man. Like, I just never gave up, and I just kept doing my thing.
Well, God dang, you're still a youngster. How's your body feeling after all the years you've got into business?
I'm 33. I try to work smart, not hard. Like, you know, it hurts. It doesn't. I'm sure I feel different from a normal 33-year-old male. You know, I'm sure my body's a little more banged up than, like, a normal guy. But, yeah, I try to, I get up, I exercise, I do yoga, I do a lot of cardio, and I try to keep it in shape.
Dude, you doing yoga, that catches me off guard. How long you been doing that?
I don't do it much, man. Like, once or twice a week, I give it a try. I need to get on the Diamond Dallas Page yoga. I haven't done that yet, so if DDP listens to this, I would love to try that and see what the best, option is for me for DDP yoga.
Dude, I will tell him firsthand you want to give it a shot. He's supposed to come out here to my place in about 3 or 4 days and help me download the app and do all that other crap. I'm not very technologically advanced, so he's going to come over and smarten me up to the app and get me up and running. So I've already told him, I said, you know, I'm old school. I'll always train with weights. I train with a lot lighter weights than I used to, you know, being through the grind. But, man, flexibility. I mean, I recently kind of took up golfing or took an interest in golf, and I could damn sure use some flexibility on my swing. So I'm actually going to give it a shot. So yours truly is going to give it a shot, and I will tell him that you want to give it a shot as well. It's supposed to change lives, and I've seen a lot of the lives being changed, and he's worked some miracles with a lot of people. If he can work a miracle with me, I will be eternally grateful, but I got to put the work in. Hey, man, coming out of high school, was it always, hey, man, I'm going to be a pro wrestler, or did you have any other goals, dreams, or aspirations that you wanted to be before you, you know, decided to get in the squared circle?
I can't remember ever not wanting to be a wrestler. Like, I started watching it at a very young age, and, you know, like kindergarten, first grade, they would ask us, what do you want to be when you grow up? And people would dress as police officers or, you know, nurses, and I would come dressed as a wrestler. Like, you know, you would dress up for what you want to be when you grew up. And, you know, my dad would try to dress me up as a baseball player, and I'm like, no, I want to dress up as, you know, the Ultimate Warrior because I want to be a wrestler when I grow up. I can't remember not wanting to be a wrestler. My whole life.
When did you start watching the business?
Very young age. Like, it's what, as far back as I can remember, 4 or 5 years old. I remember Ricky Morton's the first wrestler I ever noticed on NWA, probably in 88 or 89 when I was 4 or 5 years old. And then I noticed, like, Macho Man Randy Savage, Ultimate Warrior on WWF television, and I was just hooked right away.
You just listed two of my favorites of all time. Ricky Morton, just as far as being just a white meat baby face with a ton of fire, could sell his ass off. You saying that name at such a young age, and Ricky wasn't the biggest guy in the world, really good looking, really good promo. What drew you to him?
He had the big blonde mullet, and just the way he was talking into the camera, like, as a kid, he just, I don't know, I guess it was subliminal. Like, I just believed in what he was saying, as you know, and I got behind him. And a cool story, I just wrestled Ricky Morton a couple of weeks ago in West Virginia.
That's awesome. How was it?
Oh, it was fun, easy. You know, I'm still Ricky Morton, fiery baby face, gets the crowd behind him. I was the heel James Ellsworth character, and we had a blast.
How many minutes you guys put in?
Oh, it was before we locked up. I mean, it was probably a good 10 minutes before we ever locked up because, you know, I just followed his lead. He's the veteran, and he had the crowd going for about 10 minutes, you know, until they finally settled down before we locked up. And then once we locked up, probably another 10 minutes. We were out there a good 20, 25 minutes total.
Dude, this next question, your answer is going to make me or break me. You may just crush me, but I don't think you are. I'll guarantee you guys call that match in the ring.
Absolutely, the whole thing. We didn't talk about anything in the back other than the finish, that we called it all in the ring. And I love that, man. I love that old school. Like, I'm 33 years old. I'm not, like you said, I'm still a young man, but I just love old school wrestling. And I love hearing the stories of, you know, back in the day, the heels would dress in one locker room and the baby faces would dress in the other. I'd rather be 53 years old and grow up in those days, because I just respect the old school so much.
You know, and I respect the new school as well, with all the athleticism, the things that the guys are doing now. It's incredible. But I remember, and I got a chance to work with Ricky Morton a couple of times, and he's one of my all-time favorites. I loved when him and Robert got to go into the Hall of Fame. Going back to the old days, man, when we would wrestle in Nashville at the fairgrounds, man, it was like a rectangular building, and you had a dressing room at either side. You know, we weren't coming out of the same damn dressing room, and the referee was truly going from one dressing room to the other to give the guys the finish. And, man, like, I was green as grass back then. I'd been, you know, in the business 3, 4, 5 months. There I was wrestling with guys with 10 to 15 years experience. It was like, on one hand, I was really nervous because I was green. But on the other hand, I didn't have anything to remember because guys were calling it in the ring. And, you know, with all the repetition, working 6 days a week like we were, you know, you get good pretty quick, especially when you're working with guys that were as talented and had the depth of knowledge that they had that I was working with. But, man, when you go out there and all you have to do is remember the finish, and I didn't have anything with respect to a character because I was just Steve Austin, and then Stunning Steve, it was just a name. But all I had to do was go out there and do the match. And it made it so much easier and so much more fun. And, you know, kind of towards, you know, when I got to the end of my career, we were certainly setting stuff up. And there's been guys setting stuff up for years. But when you can hold out your hand and spread your fingers and you maybe have five base points that you know are going to happen in the match, and you can fill in the gaps with the rest of it, you might have a heat spot, a hope spot, a go-home spot, and the rest you just make up. It's just so easy, and it's so fun. And to me, that's when you're truly working the crowd. You're listening to them and proceeding accordingly. And I think to a degree that's become a lost art.
And I will say this, man, at the live events for WWE, I guess probably about 7-8 months ago, AJ Styles was working with Cena in the live events. And Cena, you know, it's the new school, and a lot of people do call, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F in the back. But Cena and AJ, he would tell AJ, I'll see you out there. And, you know, AJ Styles, the John Cena main event on these live events, WWE house shows, would go out there and feel the crowd and work it in the ring. So it's still going on to this day a little bit. And a guy like John Cena, he's the top guy in the business. And that's what he does on those live events. He goes out there and feels the crowd and gets it done in the ring. Calls it all in the ring.
And then that's very refreshing for me to hear. First of all, I love both guys. You know, John Cena's been on top for a long time, has a ton of confidence, and he's been doing it for a long time. AJ is one of the best workers in the world and can go out there and rip it up with anybody. So for those two guys to be able to, and you know, obviously, you know, when you go into your pay-per-view situations, your breaks, your commercial breaks going on Raw, it's a little bit different animal. You got to kind of have things orchestrated. But man, just to hear that those two cats, and obviously locker room leaders because they're established veterans and top guys, but for those guys to go out there and call shit in the ring, it makes me feel good. I enjoy hearing stuff like that.
Oh yeah, and I just like at those live events, I would watch the monitor the whole time, and Cena even told me one time, he's like, hey kid, I see you watching every night, that's good, you know, just like, yeah, I just, those guys, I try to pay attention to everything they're doing, because like you said, they're top guys, they're on top of their game, they're the ones drawing the money, and, you know, that's the guys you want to pay attention to, in my head anyway.
Hey, man, if Axel Rotten trained you, I mean, you know, I saw a lot of his work, you know, from ECW, and not necessarily a scientific-based guy. So give me a little bit of your background as far as, you know, how he broke you into the business and taught you the wrestling end of the business.
Well, that's the thing about Axel Rotten. Like, he's remembered for being that hardcore guy from ECW and the death matches and, the, you know, the glass match with Ian Rotten. And, you know, that's what he's remembered for. But he could scientifically wrestle, and he knew how to work. He did, you know, the Lawler territory of USWA in Memphis, and he was a world traveler, you know, before he, you know, just the ECW stuff is what get, you know, made him a name. But before then, he traveled the world and wrestled, and he had like before any of that, he did a gimmick where he was British, spoke in a British accent.
Yeah.
And you might have remembered him in WCW. He had a little time there at WCW doing that British accent and all that. And I started wrestling school in 2002, and he was one of the trainers. And I kind of, after that, like, went on the road with him and to indie events and just learned from him before shows. And I, you know, would watch him work during the shows and just pick his brain in the car rides, pick his brain at the events. Because he was, man, a lot of people don't know, he was just so smart about the business. And, you know, he had his demons and it cost him, but he was very, very intelligent about the business. And I'm glad and very fortunate I got to learn from him.
You know, I got a chance to ride down some road with some awesome veterans too. And, you know, one of the key ones was Gorgeous Gary Young. Yeah. And I got a chance to make some trips with Matt Bourne, guys like that, that helped me out. Bronco Lubitsch, Skandar Akbar, referee and, you know, world famous, you know, manager. And it's just, Paul Orndorff, just a lot of guys took me under their wings. And, you know, riding down the road was a key part of it. Getting out in the ring and doing it was one thing, but riding down the road and talking about it after you'd seen the veterans matches, you know, I would do the, you know, dude, why did you do this when you did it? Or how come? I would ask those questions. Were you the same way with respect to Axel?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I might get on people's nerves because I ask so many questions. Like, I said it once on, I think it was Jericho's podcast. Like, I think, like, if, you know, a big part of the business is asking those questions, because if you don't ask those questions, you'll never get any answers and you'll never learn and you'll never move on. Like, you know, like, just for instance, for example, this podcast we're doing, I was like, man, I'm going to write write Steve Austin and see if he wants me to do his podcast. And then I wrote you, and look, here we are. Like, it's, you just never know the answer unless you try. And that's with anything in the business, I think, whether it's learning, you know, and trying to pick someone's brain or trying to put yourself in a position. I just think you got to ask those questions. And I think I ask so many of them, I might get on people's nerves with it.
No, man, I was so glad when you shot me a direct message. I said, hey, man, what's your phone number? And you gave me your phone number and I called you. It was like, because I really enjoyed, you know, I didn't know anything of you until I saw you on WWE and I started watching you. I was like, God dang, this guy's getting over. And I want to get to your WWE stuff here in a little bit, but going back to the road, you were on the NDC, you were on the indie scene for what, 12, 14 years before you got in WWE?
Yeah, 14 years. 2002, I started wrestling, and yeah, in 2016, I got signed.
Man, I got to ask you point blank. You know, I hate to ask money questions. I won't ask what you made in WWE. But out on the indie scene, dude, what were you making? Because, you know, my first years in the business, you know, I was making $15 and $20 a night. And, man, I was starving to death. Literally, hell, I couldn't eat. I bought groceries when I could. I paid my rent when I could. I always did. Damn near got my Hyundai Excel repossessed. My payments were $154 a month. My older brother, Scott, co-signed the note for me. I couldn't let the car get repossessed because I wasn't going to screw my brother over. But, dude, I was having a hard time making ends meet. And then, you know, finally got a $100 a night guarantee. Then that disappeared. And, you know, finally I signed with WCW, and things got incrementally better. And then, you know, I had some good years in WWF before it turned to E. So out there in the trenches, you as a youngster just getting on the card, it's always interesting. Do you know Al Snow?
Yes.
I love Al Snow's takes on a lot of the aspects of the business. And, you know, many times, you know, Al Snow was plus one other match, meaning, you know, his name basically wasn't on the card. So what was he contributing to the card? Therefore, that would reflect how much said promoter would pay him for his services rendered, you know? So coming out of that school, did you have any aspirations? Did you have any thoughts on what you should make? And what did you make?
Oh, fresh out of wrestling school at 18 years old, I didn't even care, man. I just wanted to wrestle. Like, I mean, I was 18. I'm a kid, you know, I'm a teenager, and I just wanted to wrestle and have fun and learn. So right away, I didn't even worry about it. I wouldn't even ask, you know, if a promoter handed me $20-$25, I just considered it a bonus. So getting the ring time. And, you know, as I got older, you know, as 7-8 years went by, you know, I'd see what I could get, you know, like just with different promoters. Even at that age, I didn't even worry about it as much. I just wanted the experience and ring time. And like, I just wanted to get in the ring with guys that have been in WWE, because there's, you know, plenty of guys out there on the indies that have been on WWE. And I just wanted to work with those guys and learn what they do and learn what they learned from WWE to get my chance at it one day and learn what I needed to do to get there. So that's all I ever thought about is, man, like, I just want the experience. I want to learn. And once, you know, in 2011, I took over this independent wrestling promotion called Adrenaline Championship Wrestling, and I started running my own shows. Then I started making a little bit of money running shows. Like, I did pretty decent doing that, and that didn't start till 2011. So I was, you know, 9 years in the business before I ever started making any kind of decent money.
What'd you find out when you started promoting your own shows that you didn't know before, and you were just wrestling in the ring?
Oh, I mean, so much, just like so much goes into promoting a show, and so much goes into, you know, putting a card together, and so much, like, just it's a lot of hard work. So if anyone's out there wrestling, like, you know, cut your promoter some slack. He's working hard, you know. Like, it's not easy, you know, especially on an independent level, you know, where you really got to, like, poster and flyer and, you know, put it out there on social media and put, you know, it's not easy. That's the first thing I learned. Like, oh, man, I got all these promoters' nerves for 9 years, and now I have one. I see where they're coming from.
So. Hey, how was life on the road for you at an early age? And were you close with your family? Is your family still around?
Yeah, my mom and dad still around. But
what did they think when you decided, hey, mom, dad, I'm going to get in the business of pro wrestling? What'd they say to you?
Oh, they were just like, look, you're not gonna make it big. You're a small guy. You're gonna get hurt. Like, you shouldn't do this. You're taking all your graduation money you made and you're putting it into wrestling school. This isn't very smart. But, you know we're not gonna stop you from doing it. So they were supportive in that way. Like, look, you know, they told me all the A, B, and C of not why I shouldn't do it, but then they were like, but we know you want to do it, so go get them and see what happens, I guess.
Hey, how long were you actually in the school to learn wrestling? Because I believe when I was training at the Chris Adams Wrestling Academy, whatever it's called, in Dallas, Texas in 89, it cost me $1,500. I don't think I ever paid all the money. I think I might have paid $1,000. And we were in the ring one day a week, and there was probably 25 or 30 of us. We only had one ring, so obviously our time in the ring was limited, other than when we were doing the tumbling drills, you know, learning how to take a bump and all that stuff. Just actual wrestling time wasn't a whole lot. So when I first got into the ring at 5 months, one day a week, on about a two-hour session, sharing the ring with 25 other people, dude, I was really green when I got in the ring, and I hadn't even been smartened up to the business. So how long had you been training up until the point when you had your first match, and how accomplished were you, or did you think you were?
Well, I started training, like I said, June 2002, when I had my first match, July of 2003. So I guess about 13 months. And at first, man, I would go to the school 5 days a week. It was open 5 days a week. I would be there 5 days a week. Then after about 9 months of that, like, you know, me and a couple of the other guys that all went together, like, one of the guys there told us, one of the trainers, like, man, you guys have been coming every day, and we appreciate it. But, yeah, how about you come 3 or 4 days a week and take some more time? You're like, you're killing your bodies. Because in training, you know, I mean, I don't have to tell you, like, you're taking more bumps than you do at a show. And you're you know, hitting the ropes more, and because you're training 4 hours a day. So, I mean, yeah, it was 13 months before I had my first match. And like I said, for the first 8 or 9 months, I was there 5 days a week. And then for, you know, the remainder up until that July, I was there 3 or 4 days a week.
Because you were such a fan of the business and you'd watched for so many years, did you take to the business pretty naturally from a learning aspect, one, mechanically, and then two, from a psychological standpoint?
At first, of course, I thought so. But I'll say this, and I really do mean it. I don't think I got any good at it until I was about 6 or 7 years in. Like, you know, at first you're 18, 19-year-old punk kid, and you think you're, you know, God's gift to wrestling because, you know, like, you're just young and stupid. Looking back at it, I didn't get any good at all until I was about 6 or 7 years in. And it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of learning, and it takes a lot of busting your butt and just getting around the right people. And, like, people ask me these days, what do I need to do to get in wrestling? What should I do? And I said, find a school where the people that are running the school have made a living doing this and been successful doing this and learn from them. You know, that's what I always tell people, because until I got around the right people, I didn't know much, you know, or until I went on the road with Axel a lot, I didn't know anything.
But I agree with you. You know, there comes a point when you first get in the business. First of all, you're greener than grass, and you're really bad. Your posture is going to be bad. Your lockup's going to be bad. Your punches ain't going to be no good. Your psychology is going to be less than the 101 level. And you're probably following somebody. And you could be very athletic, but pretty much you're going to be the drizzling shits. Then there comes about that two-year mark when all of a sudden you think, hey, man, I got this. I am God's gift to wrestling. And then all of a sudden you think you know everything. And then it turns out you go out there and stink a couple of houses out. And all of a sudden it's like, man, I thought I was really, really good. And I'm really okay, but I'm not as good as I thought I was. And I agree with you 100%. 5, 6, 7 years, that's kind of that time where you really start honing in, whether you're working heel, baby, whether you've got a chance to flip back or forth. But I feel like, and by the 10-year mark, I really think that's when, if you've been having enough reps and being booked consistently, at that 10-year mark, I really think you're a seasoned pro and really ready to go in a major program, knowing everything that you need to know or you can know. There's always a time to learn anytime the bell rings and something happens, because it's always learning on a job. Whether you can promo or not is a whole different story. But I agree with you. You got to have those. You have that one point where you think you're really good, but you're not. And then that 5, 6, 7, you should be pretty accomplished. If you're not at that stage, then you probably ought to think about doing something else.
Yeah, absolutely. It just takes time to be real good at it. There's people on TV now that have only been wrestling 3 or 4 years, and, you know, like, and you just hope they get it, because, you know, it's crazy how it works.
Well, you know, and when you say that, it's like everything has been so sped up. It's like there's a pressure cooker on, and they're trying to crank out these superstars because they've got so much content to deliver. So a lot of guys and a lot of gals you see in the ring are really, really green, and they're following, you know, pretty much a template. You know, ABC, let's don't get anything out of order or we're going to get confused. So sometimes, you know, when you can see through the work and see, you know, the work needs to be at a higher level, it's, you know, just the machine machine moving so fast right now that, you know, quite frankly, a lot of people that are entering aren't really qualified to be in ring at that level, but due to the need for more talent and delivering content. And on one hand, it's a blessing because guys and gals are getting breaks. On the other side of that, you know, there is, you know, a lack of high quality in-ring work that is like when you mentioned Randy Macho Man Savage, when you mentioned Ricky Morton. Guys, you know, when Randy was working Hill all the territories before he came up to Vince, he probably had 10 years in the business. He was already the Macho Man. So all of a sudden, Vince straps a rocket to his back. He's already the Macho Man. He can work his ass off. He has that intensity that only Savage had, and boom, he's a megastar. Same thing with Ricky Morton. Neither one of them was an overnight success. They paid their dues and became well-respected veterans and then turned into superstars. You see what I'm saying?
I'll tell you, I'm very happy it happened for me 14 years in and not 4 years in, and I mean that. I'm glad, you know, it took that long, and I got all that knowledge before going there, because I don't think there's any, in any way, shape, or form, I would have done any good at 3 or 4 years in, but at 14 years in, I think that's why I did pretty decent, because I had all that, you know, time under my belt.
But also with that time comes, you know, with respect, you know, their etiquette, you know, protocol. You know, you've been around the horn. You've been able to watch, you know, listen, hear, see, experience so many different things. And going up and down the road, it's a maturation process. You know, you may be a young individual, but as far as time invested in the business, you're a veteran. And there's just a big damn difference in overall performance, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I could tell I struck a nerve when I said, yeah, I think there's people on TV that have only been doing it 3 or 4 years. And I, like, just hearing you, like, everything you just said, like, I thought that stuff, but I never just say anything. Just but hearing a guy like you saying it, I'm like, man, that's what I'm thinking, and he's saying it. So, you know, I learned that that's correct. What you're saying, you know, is correct, and that's what I've been thinking. So it's cool to hear that from a guy like you.
Hey, I got to ask you, traveling up and down the road, and God dang, man, yeah, you and me barely know each other, but, you know, I'm running down the road, you know, in the business that is professional wrestling, or whether you want to call it sports entertainment. Obviously, if you were spending any kind of time with Axel Rotten, you know, he OD'd on heroin in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sit there and get too deep into that. That's what I read on Wikipedia. But, mm-hmm. You know, what was your, you know, dude, I was an alcohol guy. Crown Royal, vodka, whatever, beer. You know, I was a drinking guy. Were you ever dragged in to the ugly side that can be the business?
No. And I can honestly say that, like with Axel, like he would do that stuff. He'd do it on and off. He'd go 2 months with doing it, 2 months without doing it. And the 2 months he would do it, I would tell him, I said, when you're doing that stuff, I don't want to be around it and I don't want to talk to you. So like out of respect for me, like as a friend, because we were friends outside of wrestling, we just became like real close friends. So when he would go on his little sprees where he was on that stuff, he wouldn't call me, he wouldn't talk to me, and then I'd get a call from him, you know, like 2 months later when he was off for a little bit and on methadone and trying to get clean, and then we'd go and hang out, watch a movie, and he just wouldn't do it around me. I was just never interested in doing any of that. Like, I have a casual drink here and there, but I don't get drunk, like, I don't do drugs. I was just, like, just never interested. It just never popped in my mind, like, man, I need to try this, or I've never had the urge, and I don't think I ever will. Like, I'm just not into it.
Dude, that's a good thing. Were you surprised in your early days to see some of the programs that some of the guys were running with respect to what they were putting in their body?
No, because, you know, I've been a fan my whole life, and I've seen and understood what people had, like, especially back, you know, mid-90s when that ECW stuff was going on in the Attitude Era, like what people were putting their bodies through, and they were looking for ways to help their bodies to heal from it quicker, because, you know, you have to keep going. So I understood, and, you know, it's no excuse, but it's I get it. Like, it's not a it's been around forever, and like I said, luckily for me, I just never interested in it.
Dude, I got to give you props for that, because to go through and to be in the business as long as you've been in and not to get dragged through any of that, or to have the mental awareness or whatever moral stance that it is, you know, or willpower, that's awesome. Because, you know, man, I've known way too many guys that met their demise way too soon, and it's just, you know, Brian Pillman, I'm just still in the middle of reading his book, and guys like that I was so close to, and not guys you thought that wouldn't, you know, nothing like is ever going to happen to someone someone like that. And it does. It happened way too many times. But I think, you know, these days, obviously, it's happening less. So can it still happen? Yeah, it still is happening. But I think to a lesser degree from what I've seen, or at least what I feel, you know, from my perspective in the business. But props to you for never going down that road. But I've got to ask you, as going down the road, coming up in the ranks, indie scene, all the stuff that you did, what's the worst you've been injured in the ring?
Oh, well, I've broken my hand twice. Just, you know, in the indies, catching people in dives. Like, you know, I'm too small to catch people in dives. But, yeah, I would try. Like, just, you know, being green. I've cracked a rib. I've lost some teeth. Nothing too, like, real serious. Like, I've been very, very lucky. But, yeah, just minor stuff like that. And knock on wood, nothing too, too crazy.
All right, let's take a quick pause for the calls and get big ups to True Car. Hey, here's a couple of useful car tips you might not be aware of. A coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. Removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. And placing your key fob to your chin will increase its range. Strange, but it's true. Ready for one more tip you might not know about? True Car also helps people get used cars. That's right. True Car ain't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with True Car, users see what others paid, so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. You're also going to need car insurance for that new vehicle. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars in car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
Hello, guys. It's MMA fighter Chael Sonnen. Check out my podcast, You're Welcome, with Chael Sonnen every Wednesday and Friday right here at Podcast One. We cover the latest in mixed martial arts and everything else going on in the world of sport. Listen free to You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen, exclusively available on Apple Podcasts, at PodcastOne.com, and on the Podcast One app. If you love the show, share it with a friend and leave us a rating and review.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
WWE, what happened there? How did you get in there? And then all of a sudden you got over, you caught on fire, and then all of a sudden I heard that you were released. Let's go to the beginning. You know, I know you did some stuff with the Rosebuds, but did you do some squash matches with them? What was your introduction to WWE, and how did you come into their radar?
Well, I always would try to be an extra talent when they came to my area. The Rosebud stuff, yeah, I would just, you know, when they needed guys for Adam Rose to come out and dance with them, I did that a couple of times. The Strowman thing in Pittsburgh, July 25th, 2016. Arn Anderson came over and he asked me to throw a punch on one of the other extra guys to see, you know, how my punches looked. And I threw a punch. And to this day, Steve, and gives me chills thinking about it. Arn Anderson gave me the biggest compliment I still to this day ever got into business. I threw that punch on that guy and he said, "Oh, damn, kid, I don't need to see another punch. That was great." Like, and that from Arn Anderson, I don't think you can get a bigger compliment from any, like.
Dude, if it had been the drizzling shits, he would have told you. One time I was working with Flying Brian, we were a tag team down there, and WCW and I went in, we were double teaming on the guys, and then Brian and I both set the guy into the ropes. I said double drop kick, and Brian hit the guy in about the nose, and I think I hit him in about the kneecaps. James, I went back to the dressing room after that match was over, and Arn Anderson absolutely roasted and blistered me, and that was the last drop kick I ever threw, and it was in the early 1990s. So if he's telling you you got a good working punch, he's telling you the truth.
Yeah, and he got me in the ring, and he said, "All right, well, let me see you throw that same punch on Braun Strowman." Just, I guess, test to see if I'd be nervous, and I threw the same punch, and he's like, "All right, well, you're going to work Strowman tonight on Raw. We're going to give you two punches on him. Then after that, you know, he's going to squash you, and, you know, but you get to be on Raw tonight." And I'm like, "Oh, great, thank you." And I shook his hand, told him appreciate it, talked to Braun for a little bit about the match, and then one of the writers came up, like, "Hey, kid, we're going to give you a 15-20 second promo before you Russell Strowman here. I'm like, oh, cool. And I love to talk, man. Like, I just love to do it. Even on the indies, I probably drove promoters nuts again because I would always grab the mic, like, without asking sometimes because I just like to do it so much. So when they told me I got a promo, I was just ecstatic. I was like, man, I can't wait. And in the promo, I just said the line that popped in my head, any man with two hands has a fighting chance. And I think that went with my unique look and physique and everything. And I think the fans just – that's when they caught on to it, and we went from there.
How was it working with Braun? I saw him coming along. I had him on a podcast a couple years ago, and I guess he was probably still a part of the Wyatt family. And I said, man, this guy's going to be good on his own. He's going to be a good single. He's got the good gift of gab. He's got a great look. Obviously, he's big and strong. And so he really has turned it on, and they've been booking him real good, and I'm really happy for him. You use that opportunity, and obviously, you know, Braun was going over. It's going to be a powerhouse-type job or effort on Braun's part, and you're going to be taking the brunt of the punishment after the two working punches. But dude, that promo and that match, you know, I believe were a big part of you getting over.
Yeah, just after that, it kind of the next day on the internet, you see all these memes and like all these hashtags with my name, and a guy that I've never had anything like that in the business seeing all that, it was like, whoa, what's going on? I didn't know what to think of it. The first thing I thought was like, man, I hope WWE's seeing this and they bring me back. I thought about that right away. I'm like, I hope they pay attention to this stuff. And, you know, they did, but it took 6 weeks. I didn't appear on television again for 6 weeks. They would write me every week and say, hey, we may need you this week, or we need you that week, or like even SummerSlam. They're like, we may need you at SummerSlam. But nothing came into fruition until 6 weeks later on my first appearance on SmackDown.
So what was your relationship with the creative team, or what was it specifically, Vince or Triple H?
Well, I would talk to Road Dogg a lot because he's the head guy at SmackDown, and him and Ryan Ward. And so I would see them at the TVs and the other writers, and they'd come up, tell me what's going on with the promo, and then, you know, the agents would tell me what's going on with the matches. But, yeah, like, Road Dogg, especially at first, man, he was, like, Road Dogg was great to me, and he, you know, he had a lot, like, he would come up to me, this is what we're doing, kid, ain't you excited? You could tell he was excited for me when it was all going down, and it was so cool, man, for, you know, a guy that, you know, when I was a teenager, the New Age Outlaws were the hottest tag team in the business, and I loved the New Age Outlaws, and now I'm talking to Road Dogg, like, and he's telling me what I'm doing on TV. It was just so cool.
What did you think when you started to feel that momentum shift, and you started feeling like the crowd, you had to feel you were listening and response from that crowd? What were you thinking? I mean, you traveled the indie circuit for so long. Yeah, you worked in that promotion, but now all of a sudden you're starting to get over. When did you know, was like knocking on the head, hey, McFly, hey, you're starting to get over. When did you start sensing and feeling that? Because when it started happening for me, you know, I definitely felt it because I'm really in tune. You know, I love the business just like you do. And I think everybody that does it, you know, just loves it to death. But for some people are more in tune with what that crowd is doing. How in tune were you with what was going on? Certainly this is coming out of the blue because I don't think, you know, quite frankly, I don't think I'm in the initial stages. The office is thinking, hey, man, James Ellsworth is going to be one of our hottest guys. You started to become that guy. What were you thinking?
Well, after the 6 weeks, like, and I knew I was going to appear on TV, I was like, man, is this just an internet thing? Like, guys on the internet having fun, or do these people, like, generally care? So that first appearance on SmackDown, like, they did an angle where AJ was looking for a partner, and that's when he was a heel, and Daniel Bryan told him this, you know, you can't find a partner, we'll find one for you. You know, and I was going to be revealed as the partner. I was like, man, hopefully they react when I walk into the camera, like, you know, into the shot. Hopefully they react to me. So AJ couldn't find a partner. Nobody wanted to team with him. It was a match against John Cena and Dean Ambrose. And when I walked into the camera, like I heard the crowd react. And then it was a live shot, and we did the shot. And then afterwards, I'll never forget this, Shane McMahon comes up to me, he's like, kid, did you hear that pop? He was like all excited. So when I saw Shane McMahon, like, you know, and you know Shane, you know, he's just one of the boys, man, he's so cool. And like, once he started doing that, it was real to me. I was like, wow, like, this is real. People like want to see this character and see it do something. You know, that night before I could team with AJ, the Miz beat me up on the stage and stole the spot in the match. And then you didn't see me again for a month. And that's when I came in to wrestle AJ for the first time.
But this thing about Shane, all of the McMahons, obviously, and Triple H are very passionate about the business and absolutely love it. But Shane's enthusiasm and the fact that, you know, he was right there and, you know, goddamn kid, do you hear that? That's what I love about Shane McMahon, because he kind of wears his heart on his sleeve. And when good shit is happening, he puts it over. And that was good shit that was happening.
And I loved working with Shane McMahon when I was there. I was very fortunate to get a lot of promo time out in the ring with him. And he, like you said, he's just so enthusiastic, and he could just tell he cares so much, and he loves feeling the crowd, and he just, yeah, he's great, man. He was great to work with, and he's a great guy to be around.
Hey, man, when you started getting over and the crowd started responding to you, did people in the back treat you different? Did you act different?
No, like, I'm still, to me, I feel like the same guy I was 5-6 years ago. I never, like, tried, like, I'm me. Like, I never ever think anything of this other than I'm very blessed it happened or it was happening at the time. And now, like, everybody in the back was real cool. Like, I never, like, had an issue or anything. Everybody, like, you know, and this day and age, it's a lot different than when you're in the locker room. Like, just people are just playing video games and just really staying calm, cool, and collective. Like, it's not really, especially, man, that from July until I think last year after WrestleMania is when they did the Superstar Shakeup. I think SmackDown had the most fun locker room I was ever a part of. Everybody was so cool and got along and just felt like a family atmosphere. So, nah, never any problems with anyone.
Yeah, but, man, going back to, you know, my days and when I was active, still, it is a highly competitive environment. I don't care whether it's 85, 95, 2005, or right now. I mean, guys are chomping at the bit for an opportunity, and when you get that opportunity, you got to knock it out of the park.
Absolutely, yeah, and like I said, if anyone was upset about it, like, they didn't show it to me, per se. Like, I never felt it or never an issue with it. It was, everybody was pretty nice to me. Like, man, this is cool. Ain't this cool what's happening to you? Like, this is great. Like, everybody was kind of a fan of what was going on, I thought.
You got a chance to work heel, and you got a chance to work babyface, which I know you enjoyed your whole time there. You enjoyed the ride, but what did you enjoy the most?
Well, you know, I hate to be cliche, but I like doing both, either heel or babyface. But, my favorite thing that happened, I think, is when I worked AJ for the WWE Championship as a babyface in the main event of SmackDown for the first time. And, you know, that's every kid's dream. Like, you know, I'm a babyface and I'm the underdog facing the champion for the world title, and the crowd's chanting my name. Like, that was my favorite moment, man, that SmackDown where I worked him for the WWE Championship. That was definitely my favorite moment.
You know, I've been a big fan of AJ for a long time, and I was so happy to see him when he came into WWE, and I wondered what they were going to do with him once he came in there. I knew he wasn't the biggest guy in the world, but I just knew he had a world of talent, and if they just gave him a chance, I knew the cream would rise to the top. And man, that guy has been crushing it ever since he entered the doors, and so I just think he's a lights-out talent. How was he inside the ring? Because I've never got a chance or the privilege to work with AJ. What were your thoughts on him once the bell rang and you two guys were working a match inside the ring?
Oh, man, I just, you know, my humbled opinion, I think AJ Styles is the best in the world. Like, five-tool player, like you're saying, just can do anything, could go in there with anyone, like me, a guy that you didn't know from anything, and just have, like, you know, an entertaining match with, a good match with, whatever, you know, whatever position he's put in, he's going to do well at. You just know it. Like, you expect nothing else out of the guy other than to do a good job, because he's that good. And he's just as phenomenal outside the ring as he is in the ring, too. He's just, you know, an outstanding human being, and I really enjoyed working with him.
Hey, man, who was the idea, or whose idea was it to put you and Carmella together?
It was her idea. She came up to me at backstage at one of the UK tours. My first loop was the UK tour. Like, here you go, kid. Here's your first loop, 16 days. And she came up to me during that tour and said, hey, I have this idea for when you're done with AJ and Dean Ambrose, that whole angle of, you know, being with me, and maybe I'm manipulating you to help me win matches, and you think I like you, and that's the whole angle. She's like, I'm going to pitch it to Vince if you don't mind. I said, oh, yeah, it sounds great. You know, that'd be fun. And she went and pitched it, and Vince loved it, and we went from there.
Jesus, that's awesome. I would have never figured that.
Yeah, it's cool. Cool story.
Well, but it's also cool to see, you know, one of the women, I mean, thinking about an angle and pitching it to you and in the office running with it. I think that's badass.
Yeah, she's very smart, man. I always tell everybody that. She's a very, very smart girl. Not just with wrestling. I just, as a person, she's a very intelligent woman.
What was your most fun moment as far as a television working with Carmella? Because y'all carried the money, you know, the briefcase for a long time. I was enjoying those promos. I was enjoying, you know, the things that you were wearing, the things that you were saying along with her. But what stands out to you?
Oh, that just when I helped her win the Money in the Bank ladder match, the first ever women's Money in the Bank ladder match, I ruined it.
Dude, you had me. You had shooting heat with me. I was like, Jesus Christ, are you kidding me? And then Ellsworth is a guy, you know, working his damn briefcase. I'm one of the boys. I've been in the business for a long time, but I damn near had shooting heat with me. But I loved it.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. We just made everybody believe again for at least an hour. Everybody believed again. And I bet I love that so much, Steve, like having that heat, like all the WWE, the girls, like, you know, that was a SmackDown event with all the SmackDown girls, but like even the Raw girls were tweeting out, oh, this is a catastrophe. And I would retweet and like just fire back on them all. I stayed up that whole night. I didn't go to bed just having fun with that. That was so fun to me, just creating that controversy. And I knew it was going to be fun going forward. And I knew we were going to have the second Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. And it popped the rating 2 weeks in a row there on SmackDown leading up to that second ladder match. And it was good business, man. And that was probably being with her definitely my favorite moment.
Well, God dang it. When did you end up getting your release?
It was November 15th, 2017.
And you started with them in what, 14?
No, it was a 16-month run. It's July 25th, 2016, all the way until November 15th, 2017. So you're, you know, 16 months.
Okay, dude, when you got the release, were you caught completely out of the blue? Did you sense that it was coming? What were your thoughts?
Oh, it was out of the blue, man. Like, I just thought it was, like, everything was going well. Like, we just got home from, again, it was a UK tour, the November UK tour. I was on the road 16 days, and I got home, and I'm sitting there with my daughter, my youngest daughter. She'll be 3 here in a couple of days. And I'm just like, you get home, you know how it is, long road trip, and you're like, ah, okay. I hang out with my daughter and relax, and I get a text from Mark Carano, and he's like, hey, you got a minute? And once I saw that, I kind of thought about, wait a minute, is this what I think it is? I go, nah, it can't be that. Like, you know, I'm still in this angle with Carmella and it's going well. Like, I don't. So I called him and he said, hey, got some news for you. And once he said that, my heart just dropped. I was like, ugh. I was like, yeah. And he just, kind of want to let you go for now, but you did an outstanding job. And, you know, he's saying all these nice things. And I'm like, half listening to him because I'm just so upset, you know, like it just, and yeah, like to answer your question, it definitely caught me off guard.
Dude, what do you do when you hang up the phone?
The way I handled it is I went for a walk and I just, you know, my phone, you know, because they put it right up on the internet these days, and you know, they've done that for a while, I guess, and I just, my phone's blowing up, I put it on silent. I'm just like, I was sad, not mad, like, you know, I was just real sad, man, because I had so much fun, I had a blast, and I really, in my head, I thought it was going well, you know?
Man, I remember when I got out of the business, last match of WrestleMania 19, not everybody knew I was going to retire, just only Rock and, man, it might have been 5 guys who knew I was going to retire for that. I didn't really want to, but I kind of needed to ride off in sunset. My body wasn't doing real good for me at that point in time, and so I did. Dude, leaving the business was one of the hardest things I've ever done, and I've gotten over it since then, of course, because it's been such a long time, and you go on in life. But nonetheless, you know, those for a long time, I wasn't in a good place. You're still in the business, you're still taking bookings, you're still doing appearances, but man, once you leave, you know, the major leagues of WWE, you know, how long did it take you to come to adjust or cope with that?
Like, I haven't gotten over it yet. Like, my, you know, I don't know what happened. Like, I have ideas of what I think might have happened. Like, maybe I got too comfortable, and maybe I was pitching too many ideas, maybe, I don't know. Like, I to this day. It's only been 4 months. It hasn't been a long time, but I just still don't know what happened. And I wish I was still there because I was having a great time and I thought it was going well. But maybe they just didn't have anything for me now, and hopefully I'll be back in the future is my thoughts. And until then, I'm just going to like do these independents and have a good time and, you know, try to make a living in the business as I have been the last couple of years.
When you're getting a dose of news like that and you're listening and you kind of, like you said, you're taken aback and you can't believe it's happening and it's like, oh, man, you know, so to speak, it's the end of the world. So I'm guessing you didn't say, why am I being released?
Well, I did. And
what was the answer?
The answer was, well, Vince just kind of thinks it ran its course for now. But, you know, that doesn't mean it's forever. It just, that's the answer I got.
Gotcha.
I don't know what, you know? But to me, man, and this is my mindset, like, I'm going to keep working hard and, you know, and I'm going to keep my nose clean and stay out of trouble. And hopefully they pay attention to what I'm doing, and hopefully one day I'll make a return, because I just think it, like the coolest thing about leaving is when you come back and that initial reaction, like that people get when they come back after a long hiatus, and that's what I'm thinking about. That when that happens, that's what keeps me going, because dude, I care like about the fans more than anything in this business. Like I just love wrestling fans. And I just think if I ever do come back, that moment will probably be my favorite moment of all time.
Yeah, and by the way it sounds, I mean, you parted on good terms. Obviously, it caught you off guard, but, you know, it was what it was. You handled it like a man and were classy about going about your business, and you continue to work. So if something comes back around, there's no reason why they won't give you a call back. I mean, it's not like you're going out there and blasting everybody. It's a piece of business, and it is what it is. And the wrestling business, sports entertainment business, whatever you want to call it, is a tough business. And the fact is, you've had a pretty damn long run. But the fact that you parted ways amicably with the company, like you said, dude, they come up with something, good piece of writing or another idea. Hey, let's bring James back. You know, it leaves you in a good position to come back.
Yeah, like you said, it's a business, and they have a lot of guys they need to give TV time to, I think. And, like, you know, they have, like, all these people in NXT, and then, you know, SmackDown's a two-hour show, and, like, literally, like, what, an hour and 40 minutes is what the real time is because of commercials and what have you. So they just, you know, and, you know, they just have, to me, I think they have to give other people opportunities. And like, yeah, I'll never say anything wrong about them, man. They gave me my dream. My dream was to be there, and I had a hell of a run. I enjoyed my time, and I have absolutely nothing bad to say about anyone there. Like, it was great, and I can't wait to do it again one day.
You know, and that's what Vince always says. You know, he goes, I give people opportunities, and you got an opportunity, you had a run, and hey, maybe it ended a little prematurely for your liking, but like I said, you made the most of an opportunity, so congrats on that. With WWE being behind you right now and moving into the present and into the future, are you still doing your Adrenaline Championship Wrestling? Are you still promoting your shows? Are you wrestling for other people? How do people contact you to book you?
Oh, it's bookellsworth@gmail.com is my official booking email. And the Adrenaline Championship Wrestling, the first official show I did on the independents back from the WWE run, was February 16th, and I made sure it was my show, Adrenaline Championship Wrestling. And I actually wrestled Jerry the King Lawler that night, my first show back, and had a heck of a time working with him, and drew a nice house here in my hometown, Glen Burnie, big suburb of Baltimore. And yeah, I'm my next show for that's March 31st. Like, Mick Foley's headlining that show. He's a big name. And I'm going to do that as much as possible. But that bookellsworth@gmail.com, I'm getting a lot of inquiries. I'm just trying to keep busy doing this, man. Because, I love doing this, whether it be for WWE or an independent or any company in the world. I just love performing in front of the fans. And that's what I'm very fortunate and blessed to be able to be doing for a living right now as we speak.
I got to speak to the promoter, James Ellsworth. Let me ask you a question, dude. When you call the King, Lawler's one of my favorite workers of all time. I mean, the guy on a promo was lights out. His work in the ring, he's a little bit more of a brawler than a scientific wrestler. He drew major money, was a big-time star. What'd you do? Just call him and say, hey, Jerry, I'd like to work with you in my promotion. How did that negotiation go? Jerry's been around for a long, long time. He's seen it all and done it all. Tell me about that interaction.
No, just the way you just said it. I had his number because I know him a little bit before the WWE run on the independents, but not like too much. But in WWE, we became cool, and I had his number, and I just called him and said, "Hey, I'm running a show February 16th. Are you available?" He said, "Yeah, James, and I'd love to come work with you, and you know, it'd be great." And we had so much fun that, you know, he's talking about doing it again down in Tennessee where he lives. We had a great time doing it. So it's just like that, like just that easy. Simple.
But Jerry's a very interesting guy, and he just seems he's very intelligent. And there's a guy that doesn't drink a drop, doesn't do any drugs, never has his whole career. But I was just amazed at, you know, the promos he used to cut, you know, with Lance Russell. I mean, basically, you know, he could go out there and tell such a story. And then when the match started, did you catch any of the matches between him and Superstar Bill Dundee back in the day?
Oh yeah, I watched so many Lawler tapes. Like I think Jerry Lawler is the greatest antagonist of all time, like with the promos. And so anything Lawler I get my hands on, I try to watch. And the stuff with Andy Kaufman really caught my eye, because toward the end of my WWE run, my last WWE match was against Becky Lynch, and it was very Andy Kaufman-ish to me, like the way the promo was about talking bad about women and all that. So I really, anything Jerry Lawler, I enjoyed watching.
Man, I got a chance to work with Lawler, and he was, I believe he was booking at the time. I think Dutch Mantel had been booking for a while, and I'm thinking Jerry booked it. Maybe Dutch booked it, but nonetheless, I worked with Jerry three times. When I was working with Jerry, I was green as grass. I think it was no longer than 6 months in the business, but I think it was more like 3 months in the business. Well, you know, if you've ever worked with Lawler, or people in the past can speak to this, but, you know, obviously Lawler was the veteran. He'd probably been in the ring close to 20 years by that time. I was, you know, green as hell, and I was the baby face. Nonetheless, you know, we start walking around, pacing around that ring, the bell rang, and, you know, Jerry starts calling a high spot before we even lock up. And he's telling me, you know, he's using that ventriloquist voice. He's talking about basically a tackle drop down, hip toss, get it again. And so he's calling this high spot. You can barely see his mouth move. I have a hearing loss. I'm almost deaf. I kind of exaggerate that, but it's for storytelling purposes. That's why I was called my matches, because I can't hear worth the shit. So anyway, we're in front of a crowd. It ain't a big crowd because the territory's down. We're pacing around the ring. Lawler's calling the high spot, and he gets to the high spot. And this was 15 years before or 10 years before I invented the what chant. He calls the high spot, and I, using my ventriloquist voice, I say, "What?" And he repeats the damn high spot. I say, "What?" one more time. He says the high spot one more time. By this time, I've really picked it up, okay? And basically, a guy in the front row, he said, "Tackle, drop down, hip toss, get it again, you idiot." So it was absolutely, you know, I think I scared Lawler off so bad because I was so green, but I would have loved to work a feud with Lawler had I been in my prime, at his physical prime as well, because the guy, his psychology was impeccable. His working punches, if you watch some of those Dundee-Lawler matches, and they work snug because I don't think there was any love lost between them, although they were professionals, it wasn't a fist fight. But man, if you watch any of those loser leave town matches, they're just absolutely phenomenal to watch, and they're working at a speed which still holds up by today's standards. The storytelling is fantastic, and if you're in the ring and if you've never seen that series of matches, then you should watch them, because anybody, whether you've got, you know, 1 month in the business, 15 years in the business, you can learn something by watching those guys work.
Absolutely, and luckily these days you can just go on YouTube and find those matches, and it's just that easy. And like I said, I just loved watching anything Jerry Lawler, and that was my first time getting to work with him in the ring, and I just had a blast. And I think he called the same spot you were just talking about to me. 25 years later, the same spot, but it still worked. He's the best, man, and I can't wait to work with him again.
Hey, with respect to working in the ring, you know, I got a chance. Obviously, I saw the, you know, the match with Braun. I believe I missed the match with AJ. I might have saw parts of that. I've been hitting him with too many steel chairs. But I remember you really, you know, for your character work. And I really appreciated the character work, because there's not as much as I'd like to see going on anymore. But with respect to where you're at right now at 33 years of age with your in-ring work, has anybody influenced your style of work? And are you working? You know, describe to me, you know, what your work style or your influences are as far as what you're doing currently in the ring when you're booked.
Well, yeah, currently, like, I just play off the character I had on television, which wasn't, you know, much of a working in the ring character. James Ellsworth character, very just, you know, comedy, comedic, and, you know, just, it was cool, man. Like, at WWE, like, I talked a bunch of trash, and I hit one move, which was the super, a super kick, and that's so when I do these matches, all the indies, if I'm working babyface, I usually just take a lot of heat and hit that move out of nowhere and then go home. And if, you know, if I'm a heel, I take every shortcut in the book. You know, that's like a real, like to me, a true heel should, especially smaller heel like myself, like you should try to take every shortcut in the book. And yeah, like, you know, babyface, Ricky Morton, going back to him, you got to just the way he would sell something. I mean, Ricky Morton once told me, man, you could punch me in the face and I will sell that punch for 3 minutes if needed, like just one punch. And he'd make it work, like, so just, and then he'd fire up when he made that comeback. And, you know, just so if I'm doing babyface work, it goes back to Ricky Morton. And if I'm doing heel work, it's just, you know, like Jake the Snake Roberts, like slow and, you know, very villainous, like just maniacal, and you know, like every little thing counts, and just stuff like that, man. I try to make every little thing count in the ring.
Man, I agree with you so much. I mean, because you named Ricky Morton, you named Savage, and all of a sudden you're pulling Jake out of your hat, and Jake's one of my all-time favorites. And the thing about Jake was, man, economic, and economic in a good way, because like you said, everything meant something. He was always working to try to get that DDT in. You know, I remember watching some of Jake's earlier matches when he was just still wearing trunks, working with a very young Barry Windham. They were both young. And he was wrestling more than he would kind of as that Jake the Snake character they would ultimately develop. And that's the character, and that's the wrestling style that obviously he's remembered for. But man, that guy was super effective, and his promos obviously were at another level. But just his work in the ring, you know, today, I mean, to me, a lot of guys are caught up in a lot of flip flopping, flying, and a lot of it's cool. But a lot of it's unnecessary. Right. I want to ask you before we sign off. I know you spend a lot of time on the road in the business of pro wrestling. Dude, you got any hobbies or anything that you do other than, you know, wrestling and stuff like that? Any other passions?
Oh, man, I'm a big sports fan. I'm Baltimore born and bred. So I'm an Orioles fan. I'm a Ravens fan. So I catch as many games like during baseball season. I love going to Camden Yards where the Orioles play. And you know, then I have my kids, my two daughters. They're 5, and my other daughter will be 3 this week. So I'll spend as much time with them as I possibly can. And but yeah, like the hobbies though, sports fan, Ravens and Orioles are my two favorites, and that's stuff. I just follow them. My main other thing other than wrestling that I do.
So I would imagine you're probably watching Raw and SmackDown on a regular basis.
I catch a little bit of it. Like, you know, it's kind of hard right now because the release is still fresh. So when I watch it, I'm like, man, I want to be there so bad, you know. But I have friends there, and you know, and I'm sure you know how this goes. Like, and I love watching my friends' segments and what they're doing and keeping up with what they're, you know, like Carmella's, you know, a friend of mine. I worked with her for 11 months there straight, and I like to keep up with what she's doing. She still has the Money in the Bank contract, so I'm just waiting for the day that she cashes in, and I hope she cashes in successfully and becomes champion, so I'm kind of waiting for that to happen. But yeah, I pay attention to it more than anything. Like, if I'm not watching it, I'll pay attention to it on Twitter, and I'm definitely always going to keep up with it, especially if I ever get called back. I want to know what's going on before I go, so I'm just not there not knowing what's going on, you know, when you're in the middle of something.
You mentioned you had two daughters. Are you married or are you divorced?
I am not. I've never been married, so I've never been divorced.
Oh, so you have, okay. So you got two.
The mother's here, and she's an outstanding mother, and yeah, everything's cool. But, you know, but yeah, daughters are 5 and 3. I've always, I don't know, the marriage thing right now just isn't my cup of tea. So,
dude, I wish you'd have told me that 4 times ago. It took me a long time to find the right one, but I finally got it right. Is there anything you wanted to promote, talk about, your social media account, Twitter, this, that, or whatever? And also talk about your next show coming up.
Oh, yeah, you could find me on Twitter at Real Ellsworth, on Instagram at James Ellsworth Wrestling. You could visit my promotion at AdrenalineWrestling.com. Our next ACW show, Adrenaline Championship Wrestling Show, is in Hagerstown, Maryland on March 31st. Mick Foley's the headliner, as I said earlier. Mark Henry, who's going in the Hall of Fame this year, will be there making an appearance. Fresh off of TV also. Emma, the Hurricane, will be there. Gilbert, myself. You know, Tony Atlas and Adam Rose. So we have a lot of big names on that show. That's in Hagerstown, Maryland. And you can check that out on adrenalinewrestling.com. And man, Steve, it's been so fun talking to you. And it's another surreal moment for me. Like, when I was a teenager, you were the top guy in the business and the top era in the business. And this is really cool getting to chat with you. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Hey, I've got to ask you to do me a favor.
Sure.
Tony Atlas and I used to travel down the road together. I remember I was in at North Texas State University in Denton, Texas, and there was going to be a bench press competition, and I was a big powerlifting bodybuilding fan. So I went to it, and Tony Atlas was there, and he put up 550. He barely missed 600. If he went for 600 on the attempt that he took, went for 550, he would have blown 600 up. And wow. So all those years later, you know, we'd end up, you know, both in WWE, and we'd travel down the road together, and we would actually drink beer. And, you know, obviously I could drink more beer than Tony, but he would drink beer with me, and we would go to the gym the next day, and I'd be a little bit haggard from being hungover or, you know, whatever. That was just what I was doing back in the day. And then, of course, we'd go to the gym, and I'd have 225 on the bench press, you know, getting 10 or 15 reps, and there's Tony over there with 315 or 405 just doing reps. So he was absolutely amazing because of his physique was so cool, and Tony was a cool guy to begin with. So tell Tony Atlas that Steve Austin said hello.
Oh, absolutely. We'll 100% do that for you.
Hey, man, it was good talking to you, James. I appreciate you doing the podcast.
Man, I can't wait to do it again someday, and hopefully we'll have some more cool stories to talk about when we do it again.
You got it, man. I'll catch you down the road.
Absolutely. Please stay in touch.
Hey, everyone. I'm Wade Keller, and it's WrestleMania season. So be sure to subscribe to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast here at Podcast One. I produce two new shows each week. Every Thursday on our flagship show, I'm joined by a co-host from the wrestling journalism field to talk about the hot topics in WWE and elsewhere. Every Friday, I'm joined by a guest who has worked in the wrestling business, including ex-WWE creative team members like Kevin Eck talking about Drew McIntyre.
Drew was a young guy, and did it go to his head, and did he walk around like he was the chosen one? He did, and I was frank with him, and I said, Drew, just so you know, this is how they view you.
And Podcast One's own Christian Harloff, talking about his days working for WWE and Vince McMahon specifically.
As far as the perception of him, I mean, he's the king. He walks in, and it's just, you can feel it. I mean, if the force was real, you would feel the force powering into the room when he enters.
And pro wrestlers, including NWA World Heavyweight Champion Nick Aldis, also known as Magnus, talking about the challenges facing Ronda Rousey as she transitions from MMA to WWE.
I'm sure if you ask Ronda, she'd probably say that this moment is the result of hundreds of people's work, meticulous preparation and planning and timing and everything, and now suddenly it's like, go! And that can be very overwhelming.
Just search Wade Keller on Apple Podcasts or on the Podcast One app or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
All right, everybody, give me the go home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do, I want to thank my podcast partner today, James Ellsworth, for opening up a can of audio whoop-ass with me today. I hope you enjoyed that. And I ain't got my computer on YouTube, but I'm sure you could Google James Ellsworth versus Braun Strowman and maybe the promo, too, and catch that piece of business. Thank James a lot for being on the program. It was great to talk to him, and I wish him all the best in the next few years. We'll see how long he's got to in the gas tank. I mean, he's a young cat still. 33 years of age, been in the business a while. Hopefully he'll get an invite back to the big show and get back up there in the WWE. Anyway, thank you, James. I enjoyed talking to you. Hey, man, I'm going to be doing an appearance down in New Orleans, Louisiana, April 7th and 8th, Saturday and Sunday, the day before and the day of WrestleMania. And ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin has all the shirts I'm wearing on my show, Broken Skull Challenge, which is no longer. It's the Broken Skull Ranch. They got all my shirts. I'm still coming out with new shirts to this day. So I'll be down there in New Orleans rocking some Broken Skull Ranch gear. And you can find all those shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin. And if you're thirsty, if you're looking for an IPA and you want the best one in the United States of America, try my beer, Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company. You can get that Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you don't live in Cali, check out InsideTheCellar.com and see if they ship to your state. And as I always recommend to everybody, you need a good damn pocket knife. End of story, bottom line. And if you're looking for a badass pocket knife, check out two of the ones I've come out with cold steel knives. It's a cold steel Broken Skull knife, or the cold steel working man's knife. You can get them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. I say I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. And you can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. Folks, I am on social media, Instagram and Twitter, at Steve Austin BSR. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.